hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line from Raleigh, North Carolina, our good friend Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Thank you so very much for being with us, Dennis.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's see. We were going to talk today about the latest of your essays, and incidentally, if you out there in the listening audience, if you don't go to newswithviews.com and pull down all of the articles that Dr. Dennis Cuddy has written, why, you're missing a real treat, a tremendous insight of what's going on. But what now, I think, what are we up to, 23 or 24 volumes of that letter?
Yeah, 27.
We're up to 27, okay. But this, the latest one, really starts out with a fascinating quotation from David Rockefeller, where he really exposes exactly what this is all about, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. I remember some years ago, Rush Limbaugh used to give, I haven't heard it recently, he used to give this kook test. And one of his questions was, if you think David Rockefeller with the Council on Foreign Relations is part of some conspiracy to take us into a world government, you're a kook. And so I thought, in fact, I actually emailed this to Rush Limbaugh. I said, basically, you know, what does this do to your kook test? Where on page 405 of David Rockefeller's own memoirs, which is the exact title of it, Memoirs, he says, quote, first off, the chapter is titled Proud Internationalist, and it begins with him saying how one of the best days of his life was at the CFR on a particular date. It goes on. Then the next page, 405, about a third of the way down, it says, quote, some even believe we, he's talking about his family, the Rockefeller family, some even believe we are part of a secret cabal build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty and I am proud of it, end quote. And what's interesting about that is he puts all the components. He actually uses the word conspiring. He uses the word cabal. He uses the word integrated global political structure, which is a world government, and integrated global economic structure, which is what I've said their goal is. They're using regional economic arrangements into a global economic structure, which then they will say has to be managed by a world government. And he concludes saying, one world, if you will, and if that's the charge, I stand guilty and I'm proud of it.
And of course, this, by the definition of the Patriot Act, is a statement of a terrorist, because a terrorist wants to change our form of government, and David Rockefeller wants to change our form of government, wants to eliminate the sovereignty of our United States and move us into a one world government. You cannot be a globalist and an internationalist and an American both. You can be one or the other, but of course, these people are intent upon destroying the sovereignty of our nation and the freedom of our people. And David Rockefeller, I've seen the quotation, I checked it out, and it's exactly as Dr. Cuddy says. David Rockefeller says, I am a proud internationalist. I stand admitting I'm guilty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and he started out simply talking about David Rockefeller, admitting that he is a proud internationalist, and he is part of a group that is intent upon changing the structure of our society. Now, we have a little different audience. We just brought our listeners from KKMC on, and we do not have our listeners from the Genesis, so would you mind just repeating that quotation for us?
Sure. The point here is, in David Rockefeller's book, Memoirs, that's the title of it, it's a rather thick book, He says something rather boldly, and as I've said for many years, they're sort of coming out in the open on this. And the chapter is titled Proud Internationalist, but he's not just in this quote that I'll read you admitting I'm a proud internationalist. He is going to say he's guilty of something rather specific, and listen to the words he uses. He says, quote, some even believe we, the Rockefeller family he's talking about, are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists, and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will, and as a period. Now he says, if that's the charge, I stand guilty and I am proud of it, end quote. Now what's important there is, all of the first part of that is a single sentence where it says, some even believe, all the way down to one world, if you will. Then the new sentence says, if that's the charge, I stand guilty and I am proud of it. In other words, the previous sentence is what he says I am guilty of and proud of it. And in that sentence, he uses those words I just mentioned, secret cabal, working against the best interest of the United States, conspiring. He uses the term integrated global political structure, integrated global economic structure, one world, if you will. That's a world government. An integrated global political structure is a world government. And a one integrated global economic structure is, as I said, what they do is they'll have regional economic arrangements that they'll combine into a global economic structure, and they'll say that needs to be managed by a world government. So what he's acknowledging isn't that he's just an internationalist. He's standing guilty of saying, I'm in the part of a secret cabal, one. Number two, it's working against the best interest of the United States. Another point. Conspiring with others, that's the third point. And fourthly, the integrated global political structure, that's the fifth point, and so on. The point is, he's saying, I'm guilty of all that.
And, of course, the thing is that there is an effort to destroy the sovereignty of our nation and the freedom of our people, and we'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Arthur Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course to many people, they don't really understand what's going on. Why can't we seal the border with Mexico? Very simply, because the globalists don't want to, and certainly George Bush and the people who surround him all come. Now, George Bush doesn't come from the Council on Foreign Relations, but Condi Rice does, and Cheney, and so many of the people that surround George Bush come from the Council on Foreign Relations. They're globalists. They're dedicated to the destruction of the sovereignty of the United States. Their goal is to merge the United States with Mexico and with Canada. That's why we're not closing the border. That's why they refuse to enforce the laws, the federal laws that say it's a criminal act to knowingly employ illegal aliens. They don't enforce those laws. They're very selective in the laws they enforce. They'll go after, you know, some person who's had some minor thing, you know, that they've done, but totally ignore the fact that there are about 11 million illegal aliens working in this country, drawing salaries, and many of our large corporations are employing them. And the government won't enforce the laws. Why? Because they're encouraging illegal immigration, because they want a multicultural, they want a multilingual society, they want to destroy America and merge us into the one world order. When you understand that, everything makes sense. If you don't understand it, not much makes sense, does it, Dr. Cuddy?
No, it doesn't. And while they won't grab David Rockefeller, I'm sure, they may grab you. One of the points I make in this part 27 of my series, Mental Health, Education, Social Control, is that they're setting the stage, setting precedents, building a case for more and more authority and more control. For example, the point I give is, just recently you had the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, the U.S. House and U.S. Senate. And if you look in there at Section 802, it defines as a specific definition of domestic terrorism. And when your listeners say, well, I'm not a domestic terrorist, you know, I know what they are, they're going to blow up, you know, some train station or subway, whatever, and I'm not that, so no problem. What you need to recognize, and I've alerted the people in Congress to this, but apparently they just don't care. Your own member of Congress apparently doesn't care about this. if you look at Section 802 as its definition of domestic terrorism, it includes activities that, quote, involve acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or of any state and appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, end quote. Now, there's more to it, but if you do what I just said in that quote, that is part of the law. If you've done that, you are a domestic terrorist. All right, now let's see what that means. All right, what this can mean is if you are driving over the speed limit, let's say, that's a crime dangerous to human life, okay? So you'll fulfill that aspect of it. Before, you were just speeding. Now, you have engaged in a crime dangerous to human life, and you don't even have to even intend to make people afraid by speeding. The definition, if you look in the dictionary of intimidate, is to make people afraid. All right. Now, here's the point: you don't even have to intend to make people afraid by speeding. Now, the federal government, according to that definition, can just say your speeding appeared to be intended to cause fear. In other words, you were speeding. That's not the issue. You intended to speed? No, that's not the issue. All we have to do is say, in our opinion, you appeared to intend to cause fear. Now, I would ask your listeners to think about this. For what other crimes can you be convicted, not by actually doing something illegal, like, you know, committing murder or theft, or even intending to do something illegal, like attempted murder or theft? Now all you have to do is appear to intend to do it, and you are a domestic terrorist.
Well, of course, they can interpret law, wording any way they want to. I mean, they were able to find that a woman had a right to kill her unborn child in a constitution that never mentioned anything at all about pregnancy. They were able to find a right to homosexuality. But, of course, all of those things, people say, well, you know, we're a nation of law, and whatever the courts say is the law, it has to be the law. They can twist legislation any way they want to. And we know that they have sent, on a number of occasions, people that they knew were innocent to prison, as they did even back in the Roosevelt administration, with a fellow named Ezra Pound. They sent him to a psychiatric hospital, and they kept him there for years. Why? Because he was an enemy of the state. And really the frightening thing about the Patriot Act is that we have essentially done away with all of the protection of our Bill of Rights under the Patriot Act. And if they can hold Padilla without the right of habeas corpus, whether he's guilty or innocent, and hold him for 3 years without ever charging him, and then when they finally get around to it, change the charges, he is no longer going to build a dirty bomb and going to kill all the people. I've even forgot what they changed it to. But what they are doing is, in the name of fighting terrorism, taking away the freedom of the American people and moving us towards a dictatorship, and the average American honestly believes somehow we're involved in a war on terrorism. And yet, if you look very seriously at what's going on, if we're involved in a war on terrorism, why was the president so intent upon turning six of our major ports over to a Muslim country that supported the Taliban and wants to destroy Israel? I mean, why would he want to do that if we're really involved in a war on terrorism?
That's right, and I would urge, I know I'm repeating myself, but I'd urge your listeners to think about this very carefully. All of you members of the House, the U.S. House, all of the members of the U.S. Senate, apparently did not object to this. That word appear. Now, it seems like a little thing, but think about it. You're standing in front of a judge, you personally, and you say, but judge, I didn't do such and such. And the judge says, doesn't matter. You said, but judge, I didn't even intend to commit this crime. He says, that doesn't matter. All they had to do is say, you appeared to intend. I mean, how do you combat, as a defense attorney, the idea that, well, the client didn't do anything wrong or even didn't intend to do anything, but, you know, he appeared to, and that's good enough. Now you're going to jail as a domestic terrorist.
Well, of course, the thing is that, Dr. Cuddy, the congressmen never read these pieces of legislation. I mean, they keep them so busy that they don't have time to read the legislation. They just simply vote the way they're told to by the leaders of their political parties.
They are, but in this case, I told some of them, and apparently they didn't give a flip. And so it's, I don't think in this case they can profess ignorance, which, you know, I didn't speak to all 435 or 37 with the two D.C. ones and all 100 senators, but enough of them knew that there was a problem with this and said, oh, we just don't care, apparently. And so it's like we talked about before on the program. It used to be the members of Congress were responsive to their constituents. But they have learned over the past decade or so, when there was a poll, as we mentioned before, on NAFTA and then on GATT, and something like 75-80% of the public said, no, we don't want that, and they did it anyway. And then they get reelected. And so what is the message? What's the message that the American public is sending to members of Congress saying, no, don't do this? They do it anyway, and we say, sure, that's okay. Don't worry about it. I'm reelecting you anyway. And so the ultimate responsibility really does come back to us, I'm afraid.
Well, I think that what we have to do is be involved. But then, of course, we have to make sure that we don't have those electronic voting machines that so often have a hiccup and come out as they did. There's one precinct in Ohio where there were 800 registered voters and 4,000 votes for George Bush. And somebody said, how could you have 800 registered voters and 4,000 votes for George Bush? And the response was, well, the machine had a hiccup. And everybody said, oh, a hiccup. So that explains it. We have to get back to the paper ballots. There are people, there are dishonest people who will alter the elections. We know what the exit polls were in the last presidential election. They were accurate in every state except Ohio. And, of course, that was the one that George Bush had to take, and that's the one he did take. And the exit polls showed that John Kerry had won the election. But, of course, when they got through with the electronic voting machines, and the man who controlled those just happened to be the head of the George Bush for President Committee in the state of Ohio, and you'd never guess what happened. George Bush took Ohio.
Well, also, notice that his fellow Skull and Bones, Merrick Curry, did not put up a big fight over that as well. And if you go back to paper ballots, be sure that they're not computer read, because just before you got to the electronic voting, the interim step between that and the paper ballots was you'd fill out this, like, long sheet. And then the sheet, you'd be in this little booth, you know, and you do your little check marks with your pens, and they have the little curtains and so on. But then you would feed that thing into a computer reading machine. Now, if they have a camera, which they always do, you know, to be sure there's no hanky-panky or whatever going on, supposedly, then it's no problem for them to say, well, there goes Dr. Stan or Dennis Cuddy, and we see on this computer reading machine that they're voter number 437. And so how easy is it for them to retrieve out of that machine, because they're stacked in a little pile, the piece of paper number 437 to find out how you and I vote? So the paper ballot has to also not be computer read.
And of course, they have elections in Cuba, and Fidel Castro always wins. They had elections in Russia under Stalin, and Stalin always won. But were they fair elections?
No.
And I think it's so vitally important, ladies and gentlemen, there are those who take away our freedom. There really are people who want a dictatorship in America. Our founding fathers feared that, and that is why the Bill of Rights limits the power of the federal government. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or the influence of the free exercise thereof, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It was a restriction on Congress. That's what it was all about. And what's happened today? Most of our citizens don't even understand the Constitution. They don't understand that the whole idea was to take the chains off the people and put the chains on the politicians. Well, they've taken the chains off the politicians, and they're forcing them through our population. They're setting up detention camps all across America. Could that really happen in America? Well, it will happen if you're not involved. Well, Dr. Cuddy, you go right ahead with the discussion here.
Since we had mentioned a quote by David Rockefeller, a lot of your listeners may be familiar with him, but he was, from 1970 to 1985, chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. And if you look, you won't find this in the New York Times or Washington Post, but if you go online, you can look at the Taipei Times, that's out of Taiwan. The date's February 21 of this year. And there's an article, and its title is State Sovereignty Must Be Altered in Globalized Era. And it's by Richard Haass, the current president of the CFR. Now, you'd think the president of the CFR might get some attention, you know, in the Chicago Tribune or somewhere, but you have to go to the Taipei Times for this thing. And in this article, he says, now remember, he's just like Rockefeller, and this is current. He says, quote, the near monopoly of power once enjoyed by sovereign entities is being eroded. As a result, new mechanisms are needed for regional and global governance that include actors other than states. Now remember that, regional. Remember that term. Moreover, states must be prepared to cede, C-E-D-E, some sovereignty to world bodies if the international system is to function. This is already taking place in the trade realm. Governments agreed to accept the rulings of the World Trade Organization because, on balance, they benefit from an international trading order, even if a particular decision requires that they alter a practice that is their sovereign right to carry out. In other words, change your law. He continues, all of this suggests that sovereignty must be redefined if states, meaning nations, are to cope with globalization. Globalization thus implies that sovereignty is not only becoming weaker in reality, but that it needs to become weaker. States would be wise to weaken sovereignty in order to protect themselves, because they cannot insulate themselves from what goes on elsewhere. Sovereignty is no longer a sanctuary. Necessity may also lead to reducing or even eliminating sovereignty when a government, whether from a lack of capacity or conscious policy, is unable to provide for the basic needs of its citizens. The goal should be to redefine sovereignty for the era of globalization, to find a balance between a world of fully sovereign states and an international system of either world government or anarchy, end quote. Now notice the key elements in there. Number one, it's for your own good. You need to cede sovereignty to these world bodies. Number two, it's this international trading order that you've already accepted, this World Trade Organization. So it's just a minor step to go from these regional trading alliances and governance to a global system of governance. And you really do need to not say that, you know, each nation is sovereign as some sort of sanctuary. The world should be able to intervene if you're not doing what you should for its citizens. You know, we at the global level, we know best. And if you're not doing what we think, well, that's reason enough to come in there, because you certainly wouldn't want anarchy, would you? So he's following in the footsteps of David Rockefeller. It's perfect. Rockefeller was chairman from 70 to 85. This fellow, Haass, is the current president of the CFR. And as I've said, and we've talked about many times, they're just coming out in the open. It's like H.G. Wells said in his book 1928, The Open Conspiracy, Blueprint for World Revolution.
Hold up, Doc. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and we're talking about this effort to destroy national sovereignty. There really are people who want to rule the world. This has been the objective of the ancient mystery religions and the secret societies down through the ages. But in modern times, it's certainly being pushed by the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, and the Trilateral Commission and the Club of Rome. And certainly, David Rockefeller was instrumental in very much involved with the three previous organizations. The purpose is to set up a one world government and to enslave the people of the world. Of course, they'll try to make you think you're free. They try to make you think they're doing it for your benefit, because, oh my goodness, we're really concerned about you, and wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a one world government where all people would benefit? But so we're going to have to redistribute your wealth, and we're going to have to take away your freedom, and we're going to have to limit your ability to do what you want to. But we people really have been chosen by God to rule. In fact, David Rockefeller told a friend of mine, Congressman Dannemeyer, some men are born to rule, most men are born to be ruled. Just a casual comment, but that is the attitude And when you have hundreds of trillions of dollars at your disposal, which the Rockefeller family does, and if you really believe that, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are the wealthiest men in the world, you've been reading Time magazine too long. Go ahead, Dr. Cuddy.
Sure. And several things to remember is, number one, you won't find that article in the New York Times. You had to go, as I said, to the Taipei Times in Taiwan to see this this article written by Richard Haass.
And, of course, this is an article where the head of the Council on Foreign Relations talks about the importance of giving up national sovereignty and creating this one-world organization under a ruling grip. And that is the Taipei Times, where the head of the Council on Foreign Relations is quoted.
This is his own article. It's not somebody quoting him. It's his own article reprinted or printed in the Taipei Times, February 21 of this year. And the title is State Sovereignty Must Be Altered in Globalized Era, ERA.
Okay, fine. So, but is this up on the Internet someplace?
Sure. Yeah, just type it in like that. Google or Yahoo exact phrase, quote, just put state sovereignty must be altered in globalized era, and the thing will pop up. But it's the Taipei Times, not the Washington Post. You would think the head of the CFR writing an article, he might be able to get it possibly in the Washington Post or Detroit News or wherever. No, Taipei Times is where you go for this. And it's the attitude, as you were just saying. They used to say noblesse oblige. It's the nobility are obligated to take care of the masses, the peons, the people too stupid, the great unwashed, to take care of themselves. And it's that sort of arrogance that they have. That's, Kissinger was a student, or whatever you want to call it, protege of Rockefeller. And remember that quote from Woodward's book where Kissinger is referring to our military as dumb animals, quote-unquote, to be used in the furtherance of foreign policy. And, of course, more recently, L. Paul Bremer, the Coalition Provisional Authority Administrator, was, managing director, one of the managing directors, if not the managing director of Kissinger and Associates before he took that position as an ambassador and the administrator over in Iraq. So it's this attitude, that we know what's best. We will manage you. You don't know how to manage yourselves. We know what's good, and you're just dumb animals or you're too stupid or whatever to know what's good for you, and so we have to take care of you. As I've pointed out, doing this for your own good, the title of a book back over 100 years ago, I think it was like 1901, is called Our Benevolent Feudalism, F-E-U-D-A-L-I-S-M, was by a fellow named W.J. Gint, G-H-E-N-T. And I put those quotes in a couple of my books. This is the back of a couple of them that you carry, Dr. Stan, or The Road to Socialism and so on, where it's a rather long quote saying, laying out exactly their attitude, how they're doing this benevolently. And it's a type of feudalism of old but in modern garb, where there's this elite at the top, like in the old days you had the king and the knights and the dukes and the earls and whatever. And then under them you did not have a middle class. You had the peasants, the oafs, the serfs, the knaves. In today's terms, the sort of worker bees in the global economy, sitting by in their little cubicles, cranking out widgets for the power elite to live on the beaches and bask in the sun and have caviar and wine each day and so on.
I think it's so difficult for people to really believe that there are people who want a return to feudalism. And yet that's really what socialism is all about. Socialism is not something that's pushed by the average individual who wants to a better life. Socialism is pushed by the very wealthy. Because socialism, stripped of all of its idealism, is a power structure controlled by the ruling elite who control and buy and sell the politicians. Socialism is a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory, but it doesn't work without force. That's why the Rockefellers and the Kennedys and the people of great wealth push socialism, but they never teach that in school, I bet. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Dr. Cuddy, please pick up the story.
Well, just before the music, you were saying how socialism is pushed by the wealthy, and that seems to be sort of odd in a way, but it's really not. If you look at a couple of my books, one, The Globalist or Secret Records Revealed, another one, I put in there a cartoon from 1911. It's by a Robert Miner, and it appears in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And it has it's a picture of Wall Street. And on Wall Street, there's the caption saying, "Delighted," is what the people are saying. And there's a bunch of happy people, Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, and others. And they're shaking hands with Karl Marx, of all people, standing there on Wall Street. And under Marx's arm, if you look carefully, the book he's holding does not say communism. It says socialism. And that's what these power elite, these wealthy people, are really eager to have. Because under socialism, rather than what most Americans believe in a free enterprise capitalist system, under socialism, they would control, because they control the politicians who form the government, who appoint the people, the bureaucrats, and others who pass rules and regulations, which actually limit competition or give preferences to this power elite. The example I refer to, I have in Secret Records Revealed, this is off the top of my head now, I think it's in the 1986 entry, where they're revamping the tax code. And in there is a specific provision in the tax code that says, and I don't have the exact dates right here, but you can see it if you look in the book Secret Records Revealed. It says, if this applies to everybody except if there's this company founded on this date, in this place, in this particular year, with another office in some other place. And of course, if you look at those things, they just happen to match up with the American International Group, which was headed by Hank Greenberg, an extremely powerful, wealthy person. Now think of the pull that it takes to get your own provision into the United States tax code, which gives you, and you alone, a break from all the things that the other people have to go by and perform and so forth and pay taxes on. So that's what you call real power, if you're able to do that sort of thing. And so these people, if they can control politicians, and you say, oh, how can they control 37 members of Congress? They don't have to. All they have to do is key committees that they're interested in, maybe the chairman or vice chairman, you know, give them a ton of money or some soft money contribution, or take them on golf trips, or, you know, live next to them.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Kennedy was basically talking about how the people of great wealth and great power like socialism. Why? Why, very simply because they can buy and sell the politicians and get them to do what they want to under a free system, under a free enterprise system where you limit the power of government. Why, you can buy and sell all the politicians you want to. It's not going to do you any good. But once you can begin to centralize all power with Washington, D.C., and then you buy the politicians, then you're able to control how the system works. That's why people of great wealth love socialism, and they hate a free society where there's competition, where the people are free and cannot be controlled by the ruling elite. And so he was just talking, go pick up the story there, Cuddy.
Well, these are separate things that your listeners may be saying. Well, okay, I get the idea. Wealthy people like socialism because they can control politicians who appoint bureaucrats who make rules and regulations beneficial to them. So, okay, I got that. And then they may say, yeah, okay, I got the domestic terrorism if I'm a speeder and, you know, I appear to intend to. I got that. But, you know, how do they find me? You know, I mean, what? There's 280 or so million people. How would they get me? Well, another point I make in this part 27 of the series, Mental Health Education and Social Control, is, once again, you were asking about the Taipei Times. If you look also on the Internet, there's an Associated Press reporter named Pam Easton, and this is about the same date as the Taipei article. It's February 16th of 2006, and the article is titled, Police Chief Wants Surveillance Cameras in Houston Apartments. And what she does is says that Houston's police chief, this is a major city now, a major police chief, proposed placing surveillance cameras in apartment complexes, downtown streets, shopping malls, even private homes, as a way of combating crime with a shortage of police officers. He says, I know a lot of people are concerned about Big Brother, but my response to that is, if you're not doing anything wrong, why should you worry about it, end quote, said Houston Police Chief Harold Hurt. He told reporters at a regular briefing. Now think about that, a major city, a police chief, and the attitude is, you know, so what if we want to put surveillance cameras in your private homes? If you're not doing anything wrong, what are you worried about?
I'm sure that is exactly what Winston Smith was wondering in 1984. They had the cameras in his living room. They had the cameras in his kitchen. They even had the cameras in the bathroom where they could watch him. And where is the outcry from our Christian leaders? Don't they see that in the name of fighting terrorism, that they're taking away our freedom? And if you really think we're fighting terrorism, you need to get a copy of my February newsletter. We simply point out we've never tried to catch Osama bin Laden. We've never tried do what was really necessary to cut off the funding for the Islamic terrorists. They're being funded by Saudi Arabia. Our president's good friends in Saudi Arabia, they're being funded by Pakistan. We give Pakistan $630 million a year, and they're funding the terrorists. They funded Al-Qaeda, they funded the Taliban, they got 20,000 madras schools teaching children about, you know, how wonderful it is, Islamic belief and killing the infidels, and 55 training camps, and we're funding that. And then here in the United States, we're taking away the American freedom of the American people in the name of funding of fighting terrorism. So what's wrong with this picture?
Well, you're right. And picking up on that, that we never try to catch Osama bin Laden, what I've done, and your listeners may remember me saying this, I use a test, is it reasonable to expect that? You know, if you see something, say, is it reasonable to expect that? So, if you're in a war on terrorism, why aren't you trying to catch Osama bin Laden? But let's apply that elsewhere. Let's say Iraq, all right? Why would you go into Iraq with too few forces? In other words, the former President Bush used 600,000 soldiers roughly to just shoo Saddam out of Kuwait. And now you're going to go into Iraq and you're going to occupy it. You're going to have a military confrontation. You're going to have to police the place afterwards because you've destroyed the infrastructure, and you can't trust the police, you can't trust the military, so, you know, people are going to be running up to you saying, you know, my daughter was kidnapped, please find her, things like that. You're going to have to provide security for the people, for the oil pipelines. You're going to have to reestablish water and potable water and electricity and secure the perimeter of the whole country. So why would you do that? Now, there's been various explanations. Oh, golly, we thought the people would love us and welcome us and everything would be hunky-dory. Okay, and even if you believe these original explanations, surely after 6 months or a year, and we're now in the fourth year, it's about as long as World War II, in the fourth, surely after 6 months or a year or 2 years, it would sort of dawn on you that 150,000 soldiers are not enough to control, police, occupy, rebuild, nation build, whatever you want to call it, a country. But yet there is a refusal to increase forces. Now, I'm not, you know, advocating let's have more war, you know, and all that. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying if you're in the White House and your policy is that you want to control the situation, if you want to provide security, if you want to disarm the militia, if you haven't been able to train up the Iraqi military fast enough, if all of those things are on your table and you're responsible for this, like Colin Powell says, if you break it, it's yours. If you do that, why would you deliberately keep a low number of soldiers, allowing chaos to continue? So, you know, just like we haven't tried to find Osama, why would we have policies which allow chaos to continue?
Well, of course, I would ask the question, why would Paul Bremer, the presidential envoy to Iraq, have gone in there and gone over the opinion of the American generals who wanted to use the Iraqi army to maintain law and order so they could begin to pull our troops out and disband the Iraqi army and disband the Iraqi police force and disband the Iraqi civil service? And then when it came to rebuilding, of course, the Iraqi army again, they appointed a man named Major General Paul Eaton, and they gave him six men to build an army for a nation of 25 million people. And we simply cover what General Eaton has said in my latest newsletter, February newsletter. And he said, how can I possibly rebuild an Iraqi army? They wouldn't give me any men, and I didn't have any Iraqi, officers or non-commissioned officers to act as drill sergeants. There was no way I could build an Iraqi army. So why, if you really wanted to go in and do what was right, why wouldn't you try to rebuild the Iraqi army after you destroyed it? Nothing makes sense unless there's another agenda.
Yeah, and in that sense, you would say the term is cui bono, C-U-I, then the word B-O-N-O. Who benefits from this? Who would benefit from continued chaos there?
The people who wanted to keep our troops over in Iraq, of course.
Right, and for example, everybody says, "Oh my goodness, look at we're going to pay for this with all that oil, and oh golly, they're blowing up the pipeline." Well, remember this: every time a pipeline is blown up, the oil market spikes the prices, so the price of gasoline goes up.
And of course, the Rockefellers make more money. Isn't that interesting? But I'm sure it has. There's no relationship to the fact that Paul Bremer used to work for Henry Kissinger, who worked for the Rockefellers. I'm sure that's just a coincidence.
Yeah, sure. Another thing is there's now in the news an individual over in Afghanistan who has converted to Christianity. And my goodness, George Bush and the rest of these people are really surprised. We thought we were bringing he did bring democratic government there, and the people through their vote, they say, well, we want Sharia law, which says if you convert from Islam to Christianity or some other religion, you've committed a capital crime and you get executed. So now you have to think about this. When they said we're bringing democratic government over there, what did they think was going to happen? Did they think they were going to impose Western values on these people? Well, no, we're not going to do that. That wouldn't be the will of the people. And so right from the get-go, if you're going to establish Sharia law, what happens to your original justifications? What happens to your saying, look at how bad the Taliban is? They're these rigid, backward, fundamentalist, radical Muslims over there. Well, here you've got somebody who could be executed because they've simply converted from Islam to Christianity. Ah, but there's a way out, possibly. What is the way out? Maybe the court, we're pressuring them, I think, behind the scenes, is going to say, well, the guy is unstable. He has a mental health problem. And so because he is he has a mental health problem, maybe he isn't able to stand trial, and we'll just stick him in a dungeon or whatever for the rest of his life. Well, number one, what's the difference between that and executing them if this is what, quote, democratic government or democracy, as George Bush calls it, is brought to these countries, if that's what he's doing, so that people who become Christians can get stuck in a dungeon for the rest of their life. But number two, notice the rationale. The rationale is, well, okay, we won't chop the guy's head off, which is how they execute him. What we'll do is say, well, he has a mental health problem, and therefore it is justified us not killing him, but sticking him in a dungeon. Wouldn't that be a neat thing to apply globally? Remember, the topic of my series here is mental health, education, and social control. And don't forget that funded by the National Institute of Mental Health and the National Science Foundation was a study with these so-called experts from Johns Hopkins, Stanford, and so forth, which said, these people with rigid dogmatic beliefs, these conservative types with those beliefs, could have a mental health problem. And that was the finding of a $1.2 million federal study. And so if you think that you're safe by, practicing your Christian beliefs somewhere, you need to watch these precedents that are being set globally.
And of course, Dr. Kennedy, why, this man had converted to Christianity 15 years ago, why are they bringing it up now?
Right. Exactly.
Unless this whole thing is a scam, unless this whole thing is to focus our attention on certain specific things, and I would simply point out to our listeners that from 1994, when the Taliban first started, right up until 2001, the United States was the largest source of humanitarian funding for the Taliban. we funded this whole thing. If they were so terrible in giving a sanctuary to Osama bin Laden, why did we fund them? And if you doubt what I'm saying, why, you can go and read the president's speech on the 20th of September 2001, just 9 days after the 9/11 attack, and the president said, you know, we respect the Afghan people. We are the largest source of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan. Well, aid to Afghanistan was aid to the Taliban. Why were we funding the people who were giving sanctuary to Osama bin Laden if they were so wicked?
And now we have as the ambassador to Iraq, formerly Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, who was not only a UNICAL consultant, but he was a lobbyist for the Taliban some years ago.
And he's also a member, of course, of the a Project for the New American Century.
Right. Absolutely. You can't keep a good man down.
All right, fine. And of course, you know, if we're really involved in a war on drugs, why is Afghanistan the largest producer of opium poppies in the world today when our troops are there and they could stop this tomorrow if they wanted? Maybe nothing as it appears to be. Do you ever get that feeling, Dr. Cuddy?
Yeah, often. too often. Before the time goes, we're almost out. The beginning of my article, I usually start with mental health, an issue, and then education, social control. So just touching briefly on a couple of points on mental health. There was an article by an Evelyn Pringle, and it appears in a publication called Lawyers and Settlements, same date as the Taipei Times. It's February 21 of this year. It's called Psych Drugs Doctors Serve as Middleman Pushers. And what's interesting is I've written a lot, and we've talked about various, they're called SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, antidepressants, what they are. But anyway, this particular item, think about this. In this article it says, GlaxoSmithKline was nailed for fraud in 2004 by New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. What for? For hiding studies that not only failed to show any benefit for the drug in children, but demonstrated that children taking Paxil, that's P-A-X-I-L, were more likely to become suicidal than those taking a placebo. Although Paxil was never approved to treat depression in children, according to Spitzer, in 2002, doctors, this is your doctor, you know, down-the-street doctor, prescribed the drug off-label to children 2 million times, the same year that Paxil was Glaxo's top seller with sales of $3.8 billion. So think about that. Doctors, off-label prescriptions, 2 million times, never approved to treat children, depression in children, causing suicides more than the placebo, and yet this news is not published in your hometown paper. It's not in the New York Times. You don't see this stuff. But here we have clearly an outrageous situation, and the public seems to be, for the most part, oblivious to it.
As with so many things, well, actually, we have a controlled media in America, if anybody doubts that. We carry a book called The New Media Monopoly, pointing out that five mega corporations controlled 90% of the mass media in America and effectively control what the American people think.
Right, and the second thing, before the time runs out, we're about closing here, is once again, I've mentioned autism, and there was a study done recently. It's of a UPI reporter, it's Dan Olmsted. He has a two-part series, and it's called The Age of Autism. You can find it. It's a year ago, April 18, 19, 2005. And what he did is very interesting. He said, well, where are all the autistic Amish, A-M-A-I-S-H? Because, you know, if this is a sort of genetic thing, that's coming about rather than from thimerosal or whatever, you would expect certain results in certain populations. And so he goes to Lancaster County, this the heart of the Pennsylvania Dutch country, and he says there should be, you know, statistically, on average, should be well over 100 people here with some form of the disorder. He says, I've come here to find them, but so far my mission's failed. And the very few I have identified raise some interesting questions. The mainstream scientific consensus says autism is a complex genetic disorder, when it's been around for millennia, you know, thousands of years, at roughly the same prevalence. That prevalence is now considered to be one in every 166 children born in the U.S. And so he applied that model to Lancaster County. He says there ought to be 130 Amish men, women, and children here with autism spectrum disorder, he said. But what he found was he could only find three who had it, and one of those was adopted from China and had received vaccinations. Ah, vaccinations. before which she, this one girl, had been a smiling, alert child, and the other two children may have been vaccinated as well. And so once again, you have a situation where these general statistics were being thrown out to us that, well, one in every 166, and it's just, you know, it's genetic and doesn't have anything to do with vaccines or anything in the vaccines. There seems to be some doubt cast on this from this Amish study.
Well, of course, it used to be one in 10,000, and now it's down to one in 166. So
yeah.
That's
now,
a dramatic increase.
How does that happen if this is a millennia-old genetic disorder that you drop from 10,000 down to 166?
They can't let the American people know that they're intentionally hurting our children. And they really are. I mean, you go into other countries, they don't have the incidence of asthma that we do. Why? Because the vaccines actually prime the immune system and they go on forever and ever. One in every six American children has some sort of a neurodevelopmental or educational abnormality. You don't see this in other countries. Could it be there are people who hate America and want a subservient, docile population that they can rule over? Dr. Dennis Cuddy, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Good night, and God bless you. And remember, if you want to hear Dr. Cuddy's or read Dr. Cuddy's publications, newswithviews.com, and when we get back, we'll tell you about all the books of his that we carry here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and let me just tell you about a few of the books that Dr. Cuddy has. He has got a wonderful book on the road to socialism, and it really, of course, gives the whole background of the Fabian socialist movement. What is Fabian socialism? Why, Fabian socialism is a group, it's a small conspiratorial group, began over in England, although they have extensions over here, and they wanted to use a very slow, progressive means of bringing about this totalitarian order that they could that they want. And of course they even have a coat of arms that shows a wolf dressed in sheep's clothing. And we've actually been to the Beatrice Webb House in just about 30 minutes south of London. We went, my wife and I went there many years ago, and that's where this coat of arms, it was actually a stained glass window, was. I wasn't there at that time. Somebody had stolen it. But socialism really is an elitist concept of restoring a feudalistic system, but that's not what they're going to tell you in your schools and your textbooks. So Dr. Cuddy's done a great book on his book, Road to Socialism. And then we carry his book, Cover-Up, which goes, of course, into the background of what happened on 9-1-1, that there in New York City, the children of the Pakistan section of town all brought their cameras to school on September 11, 2001, because they want to take pictures of the attack on the World Trade Center. But all shucks, the American FBI, the American CIA, and the 12 other intelligence agencies we had no idea what was going on. But all the kids in the Pakistan section of town knew what was going to happen that day. And then it was so much other information on that. And then we carried Dr. Cuddy's book, Prior Knowledge. It's a small little book. But they knew exactly what was going to happen that day. But how can you tell the American people? So the books again, Road to Socialism, Cover-Up. And then, of course, September 11th, Prior Knowledge. We carry Dr. Cuddy's book, NEA, Power Grab. We carry his book on the timeline for education to the New World Order. And it's a comprehensive listing of all of the various major events leading up within the educational system to the establishment of a totalitarian system in the United States of America. Remember, under socialism, no one is free. Only by limiting the power of government is there liberty. Liberty and limited government are synonymous. Tyranny and total government are synonymous. Which direction are we headed in America? Towards limited government or towards total government in the name of fighting that wicked Osama bin Laden, who we consistently have not tried to catch? Because if we were to catch Osama bin Laden, how could we impose the tyranny on the American people? Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out 5 hours a day by radio and by internet, and 4 hours a day on shortwave, and of course, certainly the on satellite 9 hours a day. For our shortwave listeners, let me tell you that they're doing everything they can to confuse the situation. As of the 26th, they're going to change the pattern of our shortwave broadcast, and let's see if we have them here so we can get them for you. Well, I guess we'll have to get them for you the first of the week. But let me point out that the evening program will remain one of the frequencies on 5.860, and then of course we have the other frequencies starting on the 26th of March. The afternoon program will be at 7.490. And then after the 2nd of April, it will switch over to 9.840. So next week, it'll be 7.490. The following week, it'll be 9.840. And the afternoon program will stay there. The evening program, next week, just listen to 5.860. Don't try to listen to the other frequency. But after this, the 2nd of April, WIFE will be at 5.860 and 7.520. That's the evening program of Radio Liberty on shortwave. And if you can't find it, go to our website or give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and they'll get to the frequencies. They change, of course, with the spring, and then there's going to be daylight saving, and it's going to be nothing but confusion next week. Then, of course, we certainly want to remind our listeners that we are still offering a case of my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or daily copy sale for $12.95 each, and you can get a case of them for $149.95. That's 64 books for $149.95. You've got to, of course, pay the postage. We're well over halfway towards you getting the number of people who will be getting the cases of books. We will print them up, and we won't charge you until such time as the books are actually in hand and ready to go out. But this is how we're able to reprint the book and, of course, get you a specially good deal. You can sell the books for $12.95. You can sell them for $13 or $11.95, whatever you want to. Or you can simply give them away. But an excellent means of reaching people and letting them understand that we are involved in this spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And there really are secret groups out there that intend to destroy the sovereignty of our nation and bring us under a feudalistic control. So, again, if you'd like to get the case of books, our number 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you have not yet seen that excellent DVD, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings, we recommend it. My talk, which is on video, The World Revolution, and you'll actually see my interview with Ambassador Smith, Ambassador Earl Smith, back in 1980, where he tells about how when he was the ambassador to Cuba, he was ordered to tell the president of Cuba, the democratically elected president of Cuba, to leave, which was going to bring Fidel Castro to power, and our government knew he was a communist. And, Ambassador Smith knew he was a communist. The Secretary of State knew he was a communist. The State Department knew he was a communist. We brought him to power. We brought Fidel Castro to power, one of the best enemies we ever created. And if you really believe he's our enemy, you're going to have to explain to me, why was it that that Bill Clinton and Janet Reno sent a 125-man SWAT team to Miami to kidnap Elian Gonzalez, to send him back to Cuba to build up Fidel Castro's prestige? Why would we do that if he was really the enemy, or maybe nothing is as it appears to be? So remember, that's World Revolution. You can get it by calling 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, we'd be glad to send you one. Please tell others about our program. Get them to start questioning, because we're moving, of course, into terribly difficult times. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. Until Monday, may the Lord be with you.